The vaccine for coronavirus has arrived, but the state's physicians and mayors both say we are not out of the woods yet. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the Florida group Doctors Fighting COVID joins with mayors across the state today, and they have a message. Keep wearing your masks, even though the vaccine is here. What are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, Chef Erica Klein on her tasty new downtown venture. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The death toll from the coronavirus topped 300,000 Monday across the country as healthcare workers around the country received the first doses of a long-awaited vaccine. Here in Florida, we also reached a somber milestone yesterday. The death toll for residents in this state surpassed 20,000. There is a cumulative total of COVID cases in Florida of 1,134,383. That's since the pandemic began. And of course, this week, there is so much excitement about the arrival of a vaccine for this disease as it begins to be administered in our area. First, it will go to healthcare workers, then seniors, and then others. But public health experts say, even though the vaccine is here, we should not be letting our guard down by any means just yet. As I just said, deaths and hospitalizations continue to rise here in Florida from the pandemic. And so more than 1,000 Florida doctors have joined up with a group of Florida mayors this week, and they're trying to drive home the message that we still need to mask up and socially distance. Dr. Nancy Stotz is physician board certified in anesthesia and critical care. She is Jacksonville-based and one of the founders of the statewide group Doctors Fighting COVID. She's on the line now. Dr. Stotz, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you on the show. What are your questions for Dr. Nancy Stotz of Doctors Fighting COVID, a group of more than 1,000 Florida physicians with a public health message they'll be sending today with a group of Florida mayors joining them? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're already getting your tweets. And our Facebook page, as always, is open for conversation. Dr. Stotz, your group has been around for a while. You've been begging people all year to wear masks and socially distance. But you have a new message this week. You've united with mayors, including a few from our area, like Mayor Ellen Glasser of Atlantic Beach. And you're doing a press call on Zoom later today to talk about COVID. What's the message, Dr. Stotz?
Yes, thank you. And that's true. We have been around for a while. As you may recall, back in June, we did send a letter to Mayor Curry, and to his credit and to our heartfelt gratitude, he instituted a mask mandate shortly thereafter. And I believe that has saved many lives locally. We also, in July, sent a letter to the governor, and we did acquire about 1,200, actually, signatures from physicians, mainly in Florida. And unfortunately, that has to date, you know, not received any response. But what's happening now is, as we approach the holiday season, every, you know, tendency in human nature is that we want to get together with our families, we want to be together. We love those indoor social events where we can see friends and family. And we are just wanting to drive home the idea that while the vaccine is fabulous, we're so excited, and it's going to change things in 6 or 7 months probably, but for right now, we really do need to keep wearing masks and trying to physically distance, maintain those social contacts, but physically try to separate yourselves. So indoor venues mainly is what we're concerned about.
Indoor venues. You know, it's remarkable sometimes to go to some indoor venues outside of Duval County where there isn't a mask mandate.
Yes.
And see people acting as if there's no pandemic at all. People tightly gathered indoors, no masks. It is worrisome. And so you are joining with public officials today to send this message. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it occurred to us that mayors and our elected officials also, you know, have similar wishes. Doctors go into medicine to help people, frankly. That's why I went into it and my colleagues. And we know that, you know, our mayors are doing their best. They're trying to do things to keep their community safe. But it's difficult when, as you say, people are not adhering recommended guidelines and forcing them to utilize, you know, other means to try and enforce. And it doesn't work as well. And I think, you know, if people think of them as simply a filter, that's what they are. They're filtering what you're exhaling so that others aren't exposed, but they're also filtering what you're inhaling so that if you do happen to have an exposure, it's less and hopefully your illness is less.
What would you say, doctor, to people who throughout this pandemic have been skeptical of the seriousness of COVID-19? You know, we've heard everything from the virus is a hoax to it's not any more serious than the flu.
Right.
I hear that a lot. And I'd like to get your response to those who say, we don't like the mandates. We don't see the need to do these precautions because it's just like the flu, people might say.
Right. Well, I would put there's two categories of information. There's things we know for sure, things we are learning but aren't 100% sure about. But one thing, a few things we do know for sure is that this is not the flu by any stretch. It's more contagious, but more importantly, there are not only the mortality rate is much higher than the flu, but we now realize up to 25% of all cases, so in just the state of Florida, that's 250,000 people plus, are likely to have what we call a long hauler symptom, where they can have a brain fog type of situation, or vascular problems, or clotting problems. And yes, we don't know all the details. Is this permanent? Is this, how long does it last? We're not sure, but it can be seen in people who have very minor cases. So to anyone who thinks, oh, I had it, it was no big deal, I'm done, you know, I hope you're right, but there's a significant minority who will have long-term problems.
And what are some of those problems?
Well, as I said, the main three areas are neurologic, so the brain, there's occasionally neuropathies. The heart can have a cardiomyopathy or problems with the conduction system, which could result in arrhythmias. And then the lungs can have permanent scarring, where people can feel a sense of shortness of breath with even pretty minor activity. And we're not sure that these things resolve and how long it takes.
Let's go to your calls now for Dr. Nancy Stotts. She is based in Jacksonville and part of the statewide group Doctors Fighting COVID. It's a group of more than 1,000 Florida physicians from across the state who have been sending a message all year long in this pandemic. Wear masks. They've also asked Governor DeSantis to ban indoor gatherings of more than 50 people. He has declined to do that. And even though a vaccine is here, the docs say we've got to continue wearing masks for a while longer. They'll be doing a Zoom call today in the noon hour with a number of Florida mayors and public officials to talk about this public health message. Let's go to your calls now. 549-2937. Give us a call. Jim in St. John's. Hi, Jim. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And love the show. Well, long-time listener, and thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Stotts for her work on the virus. I was just curious about the Moderna vaccine and other vaccines. I hear we have a vaccine now, but I haven't heard anything about Moderna, which was right behind Pfizer and any other upcoming vaccines.
Sure. Let's talk about that. Thank you, Jim. Okay, so Dr. Stotz, yesterday we spoke with UF Health Jacksonville because they took delivery of the first vaccine, and their CEO, Leon Haley, was apparently the first person in Florida to get the vaccine.
Wow.
So Pfizer is here, Moderna right behind it. Let's talk about these two vaccines and how this will help to drive down numbers in the coming months.
Right. So I'm not going to get into the specifics, you know, the differences between the two at this point. Frankly, I don't know distribution. I'm not that person. There are experts out there, and there are hopefully sources for that. But what I will say is both of them require a two-step process. So if any of your listeners maybe have had both a Shingrix shot for to prevent shingles or a flu shot, this is more like the Shingrix shot where you get a shot, and then you need to have a secondary shot, in this case, in about 3 weeks. And so there's a phase-in situation where we need to have two doses for every person. So that's why it needs to be rolled out carefully. We have to prioritize those greatest, you know, at highest risk, which are our elderly, and also our healthcare workers who are unfortunately continuing to be, you know, exposed at great numbers, but also we're very concerned about the utilization of our healthcare resources in addition in the interim of this time period before the vaccine is available to the vast majority of people.
And so the overriding message today is, let's say it again, don't assume that because people are starting to become vaccinated that you can't get this disease anymore, right?
Correct. We need about 75 to 85% of the population to have immunity for it to be considered controlled somewhat in the community. So we are a long ways from there, and it's not going to happen this week or next month or even the months after due to some of the things we've talked about. We also don't know if once you get even both phases of the shot, could you perhaps be still contagious? There are 40% of cases who have no symptoms. So could you be exposed and still shed some virus? And with a large portion of the population still not immunized, does it make sense to continue wearing a mask for a while, again, till we get to that area where most people are immune?
It's 549-2937 as we speak with Dr. Nancy Stotz of Physicians Fighting COVID, Doctors Fighting COVID. Lots of calls coming in. We'll get to a couple more in a moment. Lots of tweets. Here's one from a listener. I am still going to wear my mask after I get the vaccine because of other people. I'm not fixing to go through quarantine, get the vaccine, and then leave my health up to chance when there are too many COVIDiots out there. Not me. Anti-mask equals pro-suicide. Basically, doctor, what she's saying is I can't trust that other people will do the right thing, unfortunately.
Right. Right. And really, when you consider the sacrifices that people have suffered in our community with loss of life and the illness, the small sacrifice to continue to wear a mask for a few more weeks or months is really, I don't think it's a huge ask. You know, part of the problem is this is a novel virus, and we didn't know everything about it initially, and we do know more now. So let's use that information. It's just an opportunistic virus, but if you give it a chance, it's going to take it.
You know, it's really timely that we're talking to you about this today because we continue to see on social media people sharing their testimonies of their encounters with this disease. After a whole year of avoiding it, people are coming down with it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Here is a message from the local attorney, John Phillips. He's a well-known local attorney. And as he writes on Twitter, that his family throughout the year kept testing negative for COVID-19. I masked everywhere and kept testing negative. And then he said on Saturday he couldn't get out of bed. Sunday was equally miserable, including leg cramps like I've never had before. It was like a bad fireworks show inside my body, including terrible constant headaches, tummy troubles, burning up while freezing, random uncontrollable twitching, and other weird stuff. It was a constellation of symptoms which were abnormal and significant. On Monday, I lost my sense of smell. My 8-year-old came home from his COVID test scared. We reassured him it's okay. Fortunately, my wife has had fewer symptoms, but she's also endured the wrath of this. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday were miserable. Insomnia set in and I couldn't sleep. I wondered if COVID was keeping me awake to weaken me. I finally ate something solid Thursday and my body immediately became violently angry. I had neither an appetite nor any desire to eat. I did something which was part cough and part vomit. I didn't think it was possible. Again, on Friday, a constellation of unpleasant and unrelated symptoms. One morning, I saw the sunrise and had a panic attack as my lungs could no longer process cool air without it burning. I had to turn on the heat to breathe air, which moderately matched the warmth of my lungs. It's Sunday as I write this, and I'm still unable to breathe normally or feel anything other than terrible. On the bright side, I don't have a fever, and my symptoms have improved. He goes on to say, we wore masks. I have hand sanitizer in every room. We are diligent. But hearing your child has COVID and being too weak to take care of him was a terrible feeling. Thank God for my wife. He goes on to say, COVID is serious, real, and scary. It is not the flu. So there's a testimony, doctor, from a local social media influencer, local attorney that many of us know. And his family's experience with the disease. And again, he's been careful all year long.
Right.
And now he has it and his family.
Yes. And it only takes that one opportunity. And that's the other thing that's so difficult about this disease is that while some people have virtually no symptoms, don't even know they're contagious, others, as you know, succumb to the illness, but many are in between with very severe symptoms that completely debilitate them. Some do have to go to the hospital to get oxygen. That's not at all uncommon. And we're very concerned about, you know, the way he describes all the organs involved, the nervous system, the heart, the lungs. We just don't know, and it's just not worth taking that risk, especially for your own family members. I think that's the most heartbreaking is we know patient families who have had multiple people in their family affected, and in fact, you know, who have passed away from it. And it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
We're speaking now with Dr. Nancy Stotz of the statewide physicians group Doctors Fighting COVID, 549-2937. Judy in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Judy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, go ahead.
Okay. We were out eating brunch Sunday at a restaurant, and staff were wearing masks, but I had a table with a direct view into the kitchen, and I saw one staff member with a mask hanging off his ear, and the others had no masks. So I asked to speak to the manager, and when he came out, he said only when they have direct contact with customers do they need to wear a mask. Is that true?
Oh, wow. Thank you for that, Judy. Okay, Dr. Stotz, what about this?
Yeah. So what we do know is that this is a respiratory virus that is spread mostly or almost entirely via a respiratory droplet. So if someone is standing next to me and speaking or yelling or singing or just talking, they spread out little tiny droplets that can have viral elements in them. If you and that person, if neither one of you are wearing a mask, you have a pretty good chance of spreading it. If one of you has a mask, it decreases somewhat, but if both of you have a mask, it decreases by about fivefold, and it has to do with the idea that you're filtering those viral particles. So I think the caller's question, if I'm not mistaken, is regarding the food. Could you get COVID from breathing or from eating something that someone had breathed virus on?
Yeah, and are the restaurant staff following the rules correctly, too?
Right, and that's a little less clear. But I would say that we feel at this point that the fomite transmission is probably less effective than the person-to-person breathing. And just to tell your listeners, indoor places where masks are unable to be worn, and this is mainly restaurants, bars, and gyms, account for the vast majority of community spread right now. It has to do with the indoor, the lack of flow of oxygen, of air particles around, and also the inability to wear a mask, right, when you're eating and drinking. So those areas have fallen away as much more risky. So if you're looking to decrease your risk, you know, I want people to continue to utilize our businesses, get takeout, find an outdoor venue, et cetera, et cetera. But those three are, you know, best avoided. If you're trying to stay healthy, you're at crosshairs kind of going to the gym right now.
Here's a tweet from a listener. We need to start seeing this word more on TV and from our elected officials. Ventilation. Every epidemiologist I follow tweets about this all day long. Ventilate, crack open windows, prop open doors, use HEPA filters, increase air changeover. He's right, doctor, you know, and because I've interviewed so many experts like you, pretty much all year long, I have not eaten inside a restaurant. I get takeout, I do drive-thrus, and I will sit outside, but I will not eat indoors because of all of the reasons you've laid out, although I do everything I can to support locally owned restaurants as much as I possibly can. Earlier this year, a friend invited me to brunch for her birthday. It was inside, and after about 15 minutes, I just got up. I think I really hurt her feelings, too. But I said, look, I just don't feel comfortable eating in here right now.
Right.
You know, the wait staff was masked, but the diners were not, because obviously you can't eat and wear a mask at the same time.
Exactly.
So, you know, what about this question of ventilation?
Yes, that's critical, and that's why the indoor versus outdoor. You know, we're fortunate to be in a nice climate where we can still do things outdoors. I walk the beach almost every day. I encourage people to walk, ride their bike, run, and if you can even do it without a mask, especially even with someone else, if you're attempting to keep some reasonable physical distance. Because remember, the air around you is constantly being circulated. So those droplets, instead of being spewed straight across at that person, are whipped around by the environmental winds and so on. So it's much, much more safe to be outside at this time. And again, the three gathering places where masks are difficult, the gym, the bar, the restaurant, it makes it a big, big challenge.
Here's an email from a listener. It's disheartening to see my Facebook feed full of pictures of people in large groups with no distancing or masks to celebrate birthdays, holidays, etc. Not only are they being reckless, they're flaunting their recklessness. I want to celebrate too, but I'm not. Here's another tweet from a listener. This is so simple. Just wear a mask. Whatever happened to the golden rule? During this holy time of Christmas, it's a gift to others as well as to yourself. Let's start thanking each other for wearing a mask. Let's go to a few more. Yeah, let's go to a few more calls now. Danette in Jacksonville. Danette, go ahead.
Hi, yes. My question is, I've seen on social media that one of the long-lasting effects of COVID is erectile dysfunction. I want to know if there's truth to that, and if so, why hasn't that been out there more, and can we talk about that?
Okay.
And I also just want to say how disgusted I am with our governor, because you also get on social media and hear about people excited to be in Florida. There's no mask. We can go to the restaurant. This is a great place to travel. I mean, that's something that needs to be addressed. We've got people coming here, traveling here, specifically because of the lack of mask mandate. And thank you for everything.
Thank you, Danette. Okay, two questions, Doctor, from Danette.
Right. So she's right. I'll answer the second one first. She's right that we are among only 13 states that don't have a mask mandate. And, you know, while it would have been great if we had one instituted, it's not too, there's no real benefit in looking back at this point. I think what we have to do is look forward and know that there is a goal line in sight and that it's within the power of each and every one of us to make the right choice. So we can all do that for each other, as you said. In terms of the ED question, I'm not a particular expert in that area, other than I will say, as I mentioned earlier, neurologic long-term effects are known to happen, and there are actually support groups out there already for people suffering from the long-haul symptoms. But I would encourage Danette to reach out to a urologist and seek information on that if there's something that could be done.
Michael in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. Last week, my son had been exposed in the carpool, and I had written an email to his principal explaining that he had been exposed and that I had noticed when I dropped him off, the resource officer, the sheriff deputy resource officer, didn't have a mask. And I wrote the principal telling him that I was concerned about it. He's in a position of authority, and he's setting an example.
Right.
I asked him, could he please have him wear the mask? And again, I saw him without a mask, and my son ended up testing positive. Hmm. He never responded to the first email. I wrote him an email again Monday explaining that my son had tested positive. Everybody in his carpool tested positive. And still, I haven't gotten a response. So I'm thinking, like, what do I do? Are sheriffs supposed to wear masks? Are they not?
Thank you, Michael. We're getting tweets about this too. How can we avoid maskless people in the supermarket? Says one listener. Okay, doctor, what are your answers?
Right. So first, I'd like to say, what I've done is approach typically the manager of whatever place I'm in. For this parent calling, he's done the appropriate thing by going to the principal, and that should be enforced. I will just take a little sidebar and say that, law enforcement actually is suffering as much as anyone with this crisis. And in the state of Florida and in our country right now, more law enforcement officers have died line of duty deaths from COVID-19 than any other cause combined. So about 56% have died this year, and the year's not even over from COVID. So they are frontline workers. They should mask up for their own protection and for the protection of others. So that should be a no-brainer, really. The only time I could think it would not be appropriate is if that person were outdoors and could maintain a reasonable physical distance.
Dr. Stotz, with all of this said, you will be joining other doctors and public officials from around the region and the state today to send this message virtually. How can people be part of the Zoom call?
It does have to be by invitation. So what I would suggest, because this is open to the press, so we do need to have a limit on the number of people. We do have several mayors, as you mentioned. Mayor Suarez is joining us. Mayor Dan Gelber of Miami Beach as well. So we hope that people will follow this story. In terms of being able to watch, what I will say is if you could send an email with your interest to doctorsfightingcovid@gmail.com, I will get back to you with what we could do, to participate. But basically, the idea is just to get the message out that we can't let our guard down now. It's an opportunistic virus, and it's nothing like the flu.
That's right. Thank you so much, Dr. She's Dr. Nancy Stotz, physician and one of the founders of Doctors Fighting COVID. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, local chef Erica Klein will perk us up with her tasty new and caffeinated venture in the downtown urban core. That's later, but up next.
Even though COVID-19 is a virus that primarily affects the lungs, we know that a number of organs and systems can also be affected.
a new clinical trial going on in our area right now, and you could qualify to be in this study if you've had a mild form of the disease. Details next.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Escape to a world of British telly on BritBox and PBS Passport when you become a supporter of WJCT. Sign up at jacksbundle.com today.
Next time on The World, a young Latina's first-time vote for president. She chose Biden. Her grandpa was all about Trump.
He kept saying, Trump won, Trump won, but like in Spanish. And I was just like, no, he didn't. Stop listening to your news.
One Mexican-American family splits their vote and exposes a generational divide. Their story in the top news from around the globe, it's on The World.
Tomorrow at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, there are many potential problems for COVID patients, and among them are blood clots. UF Health Jacksonville is now part of a national clinical trial to determine if blood-thinning medication can help prevent this. It's called the Active4 COVID-19 Outpatient Thrombosis Prevention Trial, and it's taking place right now here and across America. So they're looking for participants to be part of this study. Dominique Angiolillo, MD, is director of the cardiovascular research program at UF's College of Medicine in Jacksonville, and I spoke with him about this. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
So you're leading part of this study looking at how to determine if a certain kind of blood thinner can help a certain kind of COVID patient. So tell us about this. What is this all about?
Yes, well, first thing, let's speak a little bit about why we are interested in blood-thinning medications in patients affected by COVID-19. We have learned early in the pandemic that even though COVID-19 is a virus that primarily affects the lungs, we know that a number of organs and systems can also be affected. And particularly in acutely ill patients, 30 to 40% of these patients can develop blood clots. And these blood clots can essentially develop in any part of the body, the lungs, the legs, the brain, and the heart. And for this reason, we know that as part of the standard of care of treatment of COVID-19 patients when they're in the hospital, we do use blood-thinning medications for thromboprophylaxis. In other words, we want to prevent the development of clots in these patients because we know that if these patients do develop clots on top of their respiratory disorder, there is an increased risk of dying, so mortality rates are higher. So having said that, although there's still a lot of work to be done in defining the type, the duration, the dose of antithrombotic medications or blood-thinning medications that we should be using in hospitalized patients, we know that these need to be used. The big question, however, that's out there is whether patients who are not hospitalized but are affected by COVID-19, so this affects many, many patients, should also be treated with blood-thinning medications, and if so, which one? Hence, we are conducting this nationwide study called Active4.
Okay, so tell us how this study will work and who you're looking to participate.
Sure. So, as mentioned before, we are looking to enroll patients who are at home with COVID-19, who've been diagnosed within the past 14 days, and patients who are not sick enough to go to the hospital. So they may have gone to the ER. They may have gone to a testing center because of mild symptoms, but nothing considered severe enough to have the patients hospitalized. And patients need to be above the age of 40 and not have any major other major medical condition. And essentially, it's rather simple. And patients who fall within this category are essentially all eligible. What we are doing is we are taking an approach so that patients can continue to stay home, because we obviously don't want patients with COVID-19 coming into the hospital or wandering around, where we would submit an informed consent, which can be signed electronically. And we send a phlebotomist to the patient's home to collect a blood sample to test for specific markers. And if patients do agree, we would send the medication to their homes. Now, the duration of the treatment is only for 45 days, so very limited in time, because we do hope that patients who are low risk do not need longer treatments with blood thinning medications. And this is a randomized study. It's a placebo-controlled, double-blind. So the patient doesn't know, nor the physician would know, which would be the treating assignment. The arms of the study, in addition to a placebo arm, would be treatment with a baby aspirin, or one of two different doses of an oral anticoagulant, which is apixaban. So these are all approved medications at standard doses for a very limited period of time. So the obvious next question becomes, well, are there any risks associated with a similar study? Well, we're dealing with blood thinning medications, and we know that blood thinning medications can be potentially associated with bleeding, but again, we are looking at using these drugs, which are standard of care, so there's nothing experimental about the drugs. These are FDA-approved drugs, as we all know, and for a very limited period of time. And we know that when it comes to blood thinning medications, the risk of bleeding is typically increased with prolonged treatment. So again, we're looking at short duration of approved drugs in a population who, by definition, is at low risk for bleeding. So again, we want to make this as convenient as possible for the patient, which is the reason why we have a system in place to you know, get the informed consent electronically. We would send a phlebotomist to the patient's home. Why is this important? We also want to look at specific markers of inflammation and of clot formation as well to identify by the end of the study, which, by the way, will include around 7,000 patients from across the country to understand who are the patients who benefit most from a specific treatment and which treatment.
Wow, thousands of patients in this trial, including here in our area. Let me ask you, Doctor, going beyond what you'll learn about this specific patient population, the blood clotting issue with COVID-19, are there ramifications, implications for the study results that go beyond that type of patient? Will we learn more about the virus overall?
Absolutely, absolutely. We've been learning a lot about the virus every single day. Obviously, when the pandemic started, we knew very, very little. And we are where we are today with treatment options for patients with COVID-19, thanks to the number of studies that have been conducted in a very rapid fashion over the course of the past several months. And this includes, for example, the vaccine. Now, even if a vaccine is going to be available, there's still going to be a lot of patients that will be affected by COVID-19 because the vaccine will not be available to everybody immediately. And the main difference between this study and prior studies is that obviously our initial studies were focused on the sickest of the sickest patients, so the acutely ill. And now that we've learned more and more about how to treat these patients and mortality has gone down, we also need to look at the patients who are at home, which represent, let's not forget, around 90% of patients affected by COVID-19, mm-hmm. Who are still at risk for developing clots. And so so having an understanding on patients who are not sick enough to be hospitalized but still are at risk remains extremely important. So understanding patient profiles, markers of inflammation or of clots that may be present in the subject's bloodstream, all this information will be extremely, extremely helpful to learn how to manage these patients. And I must say, you know, when I'm going around for a walk or on a bike ride, or I may get a phone call from a friend, you know, almost all of us knows of someone who may be affected by COVID-19, I typically get the question, should this individual, for example, take a baby aspirin?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is, well, we don't know. And that's the reason why we're doing the trial. So it's something that's out there, but this is the reason why we do clinical trials.
This is fascinating stuff. So how can people contact you if they think they might qualify to participate in this clinical trial? It's called Active for COVID-19 Outpatient Thrombosis Prevention Trial.
Sure. So anybody who has a positive COVID test within the past 14 days, who has not been hospitalized, and is above the age of 40, can call 904-244-5617. I'll repeat that, 904-244-5617, or send an email to andrea.goosen, that's andrea.goosen, at jax.ufl.edu, and we can provide all the information that is needed, send an electronic copy of the consent, and address any questions.
All righty. Well, thanks, Doctor. He's Dr. Dominic Angiolillo, Director of Cardiovascular Research at the UF College of Medicine here in Jacksonville. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And when we come back, Jacksonville chef Erica Klein on her tasty new venture. That's next.
as white women cast their first votes following ratification of the 19th Amendment, black women still faced a decades-long battle for the same access. Historian Martha Jones joins us to talk about the leaders who fought for black women's suffrage, which she writes about in Vanguard, how black women broke barriers, won the vote, and insisted on equality for all. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
President-elect Biden says his climate plan is going to create 10 million jobs, maybe more. But how are we going to know if that actually happens?
The challenge is to be able to isolate the particular policy and its impact.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The job of forecasting behind the new jobs numbers. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. In these difficult times, world-renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma teams up with pianist Catherine Stott for songs of comfort and hope.
Kathy and I hope that the music will reach deep within people's psyches and recapture the sense of caring that we have for one another.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Early voting is now underway in Georgia. Democrats are looking to flip two vital Senate seats, and Republicans face a juggling act. Can they turn out their supporters and deal with the president who spent the last few weeks deriding the state's voting systems? The Pulse of the Peach State, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, a new coffee shop is opening up in downtown Jacksonville early next year. It's called Crazy Beans Coffee. And here's something really cool. It will be located in the new Jacksonville Regional Transportation Center in La Villa. Right now, we're pleased to welcome chef and manager Erica Klein. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. And also on the line, co-owner of Crazy Beans Coffee, Herbert Bartley. Hey, Herbert.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Good to have you both on the show. Okay. Chef Erica, let's begin with you. People know you from your time appearing on Food Network and Bravo shows like Top Chef Just Desserts and the Rock and Roll Pastry Challenge. You're an award-winning chef. You recently ran Blue Chocolat Cafe in Springfield, which was fantastic. This is your new venture. So tell us about Crazy Beans Coffee.
Crazy Beans Coffee is, you're so right. It is a new venture. It's coffee, a field that I was a little dabbled in, but now I'm completely involved in. And I can make you the best latte that you ever would want, along with great pastries, salads and sandwiches. So Crazy Beans is a great little coffee shop here in Fleming Island, and I'm just happy to be a part of this adventure.
Okay, so Herbert, as she said, this started in Fleming Island, so this will be the second location in Northeast Florida. How did it come to be that you are opening up in the new Regional Transit Center right on the western edge of downtown Jacksonville?
First of all, I like the second the emotion that she mentioned that she actually makes the best latte. I just want to hear that before we get started. The venture came up actually through Erica. They were mentioning downtown. They were having a place that would probably suit our needs. We were looking to move into Oakleaf at the particular time, and she kind of brought it up saying, hey, guys, this is open, and I think it'll be a great location. Looked over at it, found that it was very strategic. It was central, and it looked like a up-and-coming place as it pertains as an industry, as well as a few lofts are being built around there. So I thought it would be a good move.
Yeah, that area is growing. So obviously yes, you're going to see some foot traffic in there. And it's promoting the growth of public transportation, you know, in this city. So,
yes.
Erica, this is a completely different kind of location for you. And so how do you plan to cater to this crowd?
So it's going to be a lot of grab and go. you know, but at the same time, you're going to have some amazing desserts, breakfast pastries. We're looking forward to serving grits in the morning, soup in the afternoon, some great sandwiches that are being made as you grab and go and quickly get what you need for your lunch and even an afternoon snack. And then when it comes down to the coffee, just can't even, we have a variety of different origins of coffee, which I believe we kind of shared a little something with you this morning.
Yes, you did drop off some goodies. So thank you so much. We're very excited to try them. And Herbert, let me ask you, after a very tough year for the restaurant industry, how are you looking ahead to 2021?
Well, we're trying to, it's very new for us, especially the fact of what we've been experiencing. It's not like business 101. Normally you can come in and do certain things strategically and kind of see a profit and see a turn and see traffic. But now it's different altogether. And because it's new to us, we've got to be creative and got to be witty. So that's been a challenge. However, we're up for it. I think that as a result of what's going on now, it's going to create a new norm as it pertains to marketing. And I really would like to be one that would pretty much spearhead and trailblaze in the area. So we're kind of just waiting to see what's going to happen. We're actually blessed to be able to be there in that place. You have about 10,000 commuters a day that comes through, about 150 offices with another about, I guess, 1,500 employees or so. So it gives opportunity for foot traffic within as well as regenerate without. So I'm
very nice.
Looking forward to marketing that one.
Sure thing. Yeah, and I hope you just do gangbusters. And Erica, let's make a quick mention of your new chocolate line, Simply Erica. Great for a holiday gift.
Yes, ma'am. We just launched that like last week. And I'm just really excited. It's on online, simplyericas.com. And hopefully we'll be able to share with the rest of the world as much as we possibly can.
So check it out, everybody. You can also find Chef Erica on Facebook. And Crazy Beans Coffee, opening up early next year in the downtown Jack's Regional Transportation Center in La Villa. Chef Erica, co-owner Herbert Bartley, best of luck. Have a great holiday, and we look forward
Thank
to
you.
Checking out the new place in the new year.
Look
yes, we can't
it.
Wait.
And check it out, everybody. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. And the few of us that are in the building right now, we can't wait to try those goodies from Chef Erica. That'll be happening in just a few minutes. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you missed any part of the show, catch our podcast later today or our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. And have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.